Welcome to The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fourth Age podcast continuing recap of The Gathering Storm. This episode will start with Chapter 24 and move on from there. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with me this episode is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be back, as always. Looking forward to moving on to some of the probably most interesting chapters in the books.
Before we go on, of course, as we're discussing The Gathering Storm, postulating on Towers of Midnight, and reviewing pretty much every book in the series, and some books probably outside of the series, television shows, and various other things, it should be noted that there are going to be liberal amounts of spoilers in this episode. So if you've not read all the way through The Gathering Storm, you probably want to tune out now.
Yeah, absolutely. We will not only probably spoil almost everything in the Wheel of Time series, but we frequently cross over into other TV series, movies, books, anything we can think of that is relevant, at least at the moment that we're discussing the Wheel of Time. So we'll try to give fair warning before we cross over into any other series and spoil something for you. But we will apologize in advance if we don't, or if the editors miss it. I, of course, had a very famous faux pas in which I spoiled the ending of Mistborn for a lot of people. So we'll really endeavor not to do that again.
So, as I said earlier, we'll be beginning with Chapter 24, which is titled A New Commitment. Gawain rides Challenge into Gareth Bryn's camp. He was committed 2 days ago when he left Sleet in Dorlan. He knows the younglings will not really be surprised after the negative things he said about Elida and the Aes Sedai. No one else knows that he helped Sawan escape or that he loves Gawain. For the first time in months, his actions match his heart. On his way into the camp, he is surprised to see an Aes Sedai face amongst the washwomen. The guard at the palisade, Sergeant Cords, assumes he is a recruit and tries to send him to Captain Alden. Gawain identifies himself, but the guards just laugh. Because of his exhaustion, Gawain foolishly attacks the guards, disabling all four of them. Bowmen quickly take aim at him, and he drops his sword. Very shortly thereafter, Gareth Bryn arrives. Bryn takes him to his tent and gives him a severe tongue-lashing for his behavior. He chides Gawain for not being with Elaine and Camelin. Only slightly cowed, Gawain insists that they must rescue Egwene. He casually mentions that he saw an Aes Sedai in the camp, and Bryn is surprised. Concerned that she might be sent by the White Tower as a spy, they go to look for her. Gawain questions why Bryn left Camelin. He refuses to listen to Bryn's explanation of Morghese and Gabriel. He still believes that Rand is a monster, despite what anyone tells him to the contrary. They find the Aes Sedai, and it turns out that she is Shemarin. She has been masquerading as Lady Tagrin, and they take her to the Aes Sedai camp from there.
This is an interesting chapter. I think it's one of the ones that you sort of referred to some characters as glue characters. I think this is another sort of glue chapter. It's a way to sort of touch base with Gawain and, you know, make sure that he's just not completely left out of the whole thing. And by the way, I apologize for our variance in pronunciations. We're anxiously and eagerly looking forward to an interview with Alan and Maria, who are Team Jordan in the background, and hope to resolve some of these pronunciation differentials.
Yeah, definitely. So, I'm not terribly surprised by Gawain's actions here. A lot of people are like, oh, he just goes and lays out the guards. Well, I mean, number one, he really does think about it. And he realizes that, you know, if he's sent to the recruit station and he has to explain his way up to that person, then that person's going to send him to somebody else who he's going to have to re-explain, and it's going to take forever to reach Bryn. I mean, he kind of knows that Bryn's going to come if there's a major disturbance. And more than that, Gawain's also a prince. I mean, they don't really focus on it very much. They focus on him being, you know, noble and courteous and everything. But he's a prince. He's got a certain level of arrogance that he has a right to. He is very good with a sword, you know, and you know, he expects when he comes into Bryn's camp to say, you know, I am the first prince of the Sword of Andor, bring me Gareth Bryn, and somebody does it because, well, that's what you do with someone who is of significantly higher social rank than you are.
Mm-hmm. I just love it because truly, he and Galad and Rand have so much in common. I mean, it's kind of funny. I mean, especially when you consider that Rand was not born to the nobility. He's never been brought up as, you know, one of the royals, if you will. And yet, he's grown into that thing. But, you know, when you were saying that, I was just hearing in my mind Rand saying, I am the Dragon Reborn. You know, I am the Dragon Reborn. He's just arrogance, you know, personified, and Gawain and Galad are a little bit like that too, although at heart they're all pretty much nice guys. You know, they don't lord it over people, you know, the way we've seen some of the dilettante nobles do, you know, in other chapters, you know, SPN and some of those others who are just, you know, obnoxious and what is the word I'm looking for? You know, they rub their nobility in everybody's faces, and they treat people like dirt, you know, and so these guys are all generally fairly polite unless they're pushed. They're pretty much just nice guys. And yet they're all at odds with each other over something that doesn't even exist anymore, an issue that isn't even an issue. And I'm really looking forward to a meeting between one or more of them. I'm very certain that, you know, it's going to be, especially when Rand and Glod meet. Now I'm crossing over into other chapters, but I think it'll be shocking. I'm not sure it's going to turn out the way that we think.
Yeah. One of the things, and it's noted here in the chapter notes, we should also point out a very large thank you, as always, to Encyclopedia Watt for providing the meat of the chapter summaries. There are a few things that we edit out for time's sake, not listing the multiple names of people who are writing with other people and various other things like that. But by and large, everything that we do for the chapter summaries comes from Encyclopedia Watt, and they have chapter notes after each one. And one of the things that they note here, and it's something that I would have brought up as well, is that Gawain is horribly, horribly obsessed with the idea that Rand is a raving monster that needs to be destroyed. And nothing anyone tells him, regardless at all, and that seems to sway him at all. And it seems a little too convenient. And I was wondering, as we were wrapping up the last episode, as to whether or not one of the Forsaken maybe got a hold of him. Because we do know that, you know, Mesaana's been in the White Tower, and we know that various people do go and join the various mediating teams that have been meeting in the bridge towns and, you know, possibly where Gawain has been from time to time. It is really possible that they've purposefully set something in his mind to turn him against Rand on purpose.
It's very possible. It certainly would, you know, even if they didn't have any direct reason for it, it would fulfill the order given in previous books to let the Lord of Chaos rule, and prevents them from making a rather powerful alliance between Rand. They've already got Rand and Elaine, which they've tried to break up on numerous occasions, and having Gawain added into that mix, you know, would even make a more powerful alliance. So that's extremely possible, and I must confess, something I had not thought about. I mean, it's just, you know, really, since even before the White Tower coup, Gawain has been completely obsessed and more than a little bit crazy on that subject and just does not listen to anything, even though, Min has told him, you know, he's heard that Elaine is in love with Rand. You know, everyone has told him that he did not kill Morghese and that Elaine is alive and she's fine and that she's in love with him, and he just won't hear it. He just won't hear it. You know, even when it, proof in front of him, you know, that, you know, when Rand Dalthor escaped from the box and Galena and everything like that, he still just doesn't want to believe. I'm not even sure he completely believes he's the Dragon Reborn. Although he did think to himself he would see if the Dragon Reborn could live with the sword through his chest, you know, but it is pretty much obsessive, and I do have to suspect some outside influence. And there, as you mentioned, there are a lot of people that could have done it. We don't really know what some of the higher up minions have been taught. Aldiaran obviously was taught traveling, and who knows who else was taught perhaps something with compulsion. He's certainly been in plenty of contact with Catarine Alruden, and she's a black. Galena, another black. You know, let alone Masana. So yeah, it's a definite possibility. I wonder about that. And I guess they can just, we saw Mogedion do it. She can just remotely lay a weave of compulsion on somebody without them even knowing that she's doing anything, because she, you know, she zapped one on that innkeeper when she was racing up the stairs to go and blast Nynaeve out of the water. Just literally threw a weave of compulsion at her on the run, you know, without even saying two words hardly to the woman. So we know that it can be done just by being in proximity.
Yeah. You would think that coming from his first mentor, and, you know, one of the men he has to probably trust the most in the world, you know, coming from Gareth Bryn, and Bryn's, you know, sentiment on the entire thing is extremely remarkable. I mean,
yeah.
He's extremely frank about it, and, you know, he's like, you know, it's not just me talking as a jilted lover. Let's see if I can't find that, because... All right, because I actually found it. Bryn looked him directly in the eyes. His gaze was so solid, like eyes carved of granite. I'll always speak the truth, Gawain, no matter who challenges me on it. It's hard to hear, well, it's harder to live. No good comes from spreading complaints, but her son needs to know. In the end, Gawain, your mother turned against Andor by embracing Gabriel. She needed to be removed. If all four did that for us, then we have need to thank him.
Wow. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. That's pretty harsh, really.
Oh, and he continues on. You know, these aren't the words of a spurned lover, and he continues later, I can accept that a woman can lose affection for a man and bestow it on another. Yes, Morghese the woman, I can forgive, but Morghese the queen. She gave the kingdom to that snake. She sent her allies to be beaten and imprisoned. She wasn't right in her mind. Sometimes, when a soldier's arm festers, it needs to be cut free to save the man's life. I am pleased at Elaine's success, and it is a wound to speak these words, but you have to bury that hatred of Althor. He wasn't the problem, your mother was.
Wow.
I mean,
yeah, I had forgotten just how harshly he laid that out on the line for him, but, you know, he was right. Because he doesn't know that Gabriel was Robin. He doesn't know that he's under compulsion.
He's probably heard those rumors, too. I mean, if they've heard rumors that Rand killed her, they've obviously probably also heard the ones that Rand spread out. Because, I mean, Rand did. He basically had it announced all over the place. It's like, no, you know, Morghese was under the sway of Lord Gabriel, and Gabriel was one of the Forsaken. So, I mean, you know... It's all, you know, what rumors you believe, and it's just, I just find it amazingly hard to believe that Gawain, despite everyone giving, and particularly because when Egwene and Min and them all meet at the White Tower in the very beginning, back in the Great Hunt, Gawain talks about, you know, wondering if he's Taveren. And, you know, talking about how he keeps meeting people who meet Randall Thor, even if they don't know his name, and how their lives are changed by just being around him. And, you know, it's such, you know, laudable and, you know, complimentary and everything. And then it takes this horrible shift that no one seems to be able to break him out of. And it really does. It just seems far too convenient to be happenstance.
No, and it's really out of character for him because he's never seemed to be the sort of person to hold a hard and implacable opinion of anybody like that, especially a negative one, because I mean, his basic personality seems to be, you know, friendly, happy, pretty much a nice guy. You know, I'm not going to say a big fluffy puppy dog, but a little bit. You know, he seems like just generally a pretty easygoing, nice guy. He doesn't seem the sort of person to take a stand like that against all reason and hold it with such an unshakable emotion. It just doesn't seem like his. And the other thing that seemed really wildly out of character to me is, I mean, the only thing that Gawain has really sworn to his whole life was to protect Elaine and be first prince of the sword, his blood before hers, et cetera, et cetera. And yet he gets to the White Tower, and even after Elaine is in and out of the White Tower and has told him that she's on orders and everything like that, he takes this hate against the Aes Sedai for using her. And that, I thought that was odd and excessive. And then when the coup happens, okay, he had to take a side. Well, did he? He didn't really have to take a side. He could have stood aside from the whole thing. If he wanted to, he could have. And he could have kept the younglings out of the fight, too. You know, he could have just said, this is Aes Sedai business. It's none of ours. But instead, he goes in single combat and kills his two mentors and friends, Hamara and Cullen, the Blade Masters that were training the warders. I thought that was extraordinarily out of character. You know, no matter how committed he was, I could see him doing something like that in direct defense of Elaine or Andor, but on the side of opposing or deposing an Amulan? No. Most men just stand aside when Aes Sedai are doing stuff like that without direct orders. And even then, a lot wouldn't have gotten involved in that. Look at the whole thing. You're right. I think there is something going on with him. I think it's probably compulsion. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm not sure. Anything else that you wanted to bring up in this particular episode?
The other thing I did really want to bring up, Shemarin, the yellow Aes Sedai who was demoted to accepted, pops up again in this one and is exposed as hiding in the camp of Gareth Bryn. That kind of surprised me, too. First of all, why didn't she just go to the Saladar Aes Sedai? Why is she hiding in the camp of their armsmen? I mean, I know they kind of explained it, but that just seemed odd to me. I mean, if I were actually, I and Elida ran something like that on me, I don't know, even being somewhat more diffident probably than most Aes Sedai are, I'm not sure I wouldn't have just gone and went, look what this stupid woman did. I'm still an Aes Sedai, you know, take me in. And of course, the Saladar Aes Sedai would have. The Gawain would have probably welcomed her with open arms. I mean, they might have given her a little bit of cautionary suspicion in case she were a spy, but knowing, as they did firsthand from reading Elida's papers in her study in Telemanriad, that she was demoted unjustly, they probably would have accepted her full value. And
yeah.
The thing that kind of makes me wonder is, apart from all of that, is she keeps popping up. In book after book, we keep hearing about Shemarin, and now we've actually met her again. We've only actually met her one other time when she was in Elida's study. It makes me wonder if she doesn't have some larger purpose to fill down the road. I mean, I'm getting so suspicious of plot twists and turnarounds that I'm looking at, okay, here's Shemarin, demoted, accepted back again. What's going to happen? Is she going to end up being Amarlin or what?
Yeah, I mean, it is really easy to start seeing significance in people showing up. I mean, the biggest part of it, you with her and, you know, just the sheer unthinkableness of, you know, why didn't she just stand up for herself, or why didn't she just, you know, go directly to people who would recognize her in that. I mean, she literally, and I don't know how it is, but she literally believes that the Emerlin has the power to demote an Aes Sedai. And it's, Gawain brings this up at some point in time. I don't know if we've already discussed it in a chapter or whether it ends up being brought up in a future chapter. But Gawain points out, it's like, the only reason that this is happening, you know, thanks to Sylviana mentioning it, you know, the only reason it's effective at all is that they let it be effective.
Yeah, she accepted it.
And you know, it kind of speaks,
no,
I mean, how weak-willed do you have to be to just, you know, accept a egregiously improper, you know, because, you know, we'll see this in an upcoming chapter. When Shemarin comes before the Rebel Aes Sedai, she starts begging like an accepted. She's like, oh, please, I know I ran away from the tower. And they're like, what are you talking about? I mean, seriously, stand up and act like yourself.
Well, as I said, she, no pun intended originally, she accepted it.
Yeah.
And became accepted. But again, I'm going to go back to our, you know, lately seems to be favorite plot device. She was in the White Tower, plenty of black sisters in the White Tower, Masana in the White Tower. Maybe she's part of a larger plot, had a little compulsion weave put on her too. We just don't know. I mean, it's one of the things that bothers me about compulsion is it's too powerful. It's just, it almost distorts the magic system of the world, if you know, don't mind the reference to that Brandon Sanderson's always making about magic systems. But the One Tower is basically a magic system. And it's just, it's like balefire. It has to have some brakes on it, or it's just too easy for every strong character to go around and, you know, putting compulsion on anybody else they can lay their hands on. And it does, in fact, cause chaos, which is, of course, what the Dark One wants. But it's just, it's too much power in somebody's hands, really. And it becomes, I think, in essence, too convenient of a plot device in a lot of ways. And the only reason I'm bringing this up is because I wonder if Robert Jordan would have actually done this to this extent, you know, to use the compulsion to that extent, because he's generally pretty sensitive about the overuse of power. He's really gone to great extents not to make any of his characters have too much power so that they're just, you know, invincible.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It is also just the fact that we've latched on to there's this thing that can be done to people that makes them act oddly. So anytime we see anyone acting oddly, our first gut reaction is to, well, maybe they were compulsed. Maybe they were compelled. And honestly, you know, there are probably times where we are overusing compulsion. Just because, I mean, it's a convenient excuse that will explain away a deviation from what we see as being the norm in a character. But, you know, I don't know.
But then again, you know, a writer owes it to his readers to keep his characters in character to a certain extent. I mean, obviously there are going to be extreme circumstances where someone will act out of character, as we've talked about in the last chapters, where we've seen Randall Thor pushed to the point where he broke his one rule and moved completely out of character in two separate instances. Anybody can be pushed to that point, but again, that's too powerful of a plot device too. You can't just do that to everybody. You have to keep your characters in characters, or it's all just chaos. And really, you can't build a worldview and a plot line around complete chaos, not and keep people's attention the way Robert Jordan has. And he's been very good about not throwing in, you know, random happenstances. And there's a literary word for, you know, the sort of, and I'm probably going to mangle the Latin, the deus ex machina, or machina, deus ex machina, you know, the act of God, the thing that happens, you know, against all laws of nature and physics or whatever, to save the characters. He doesn't do that. You know, he doesn't do the classic thing, you know, where the heroes are all in desperate peril and fighting for their lives, and in the next chapter you see them walking away, well, oh, we got out of that one. Whew. You know, he doesn't do that. He resolves issues in a manner that is consistent with his world that he's built. And this just seems like he introduced compulsion for a reason, and he hasn't really overused it. In fact, there have been times when situations where I thought it was very probable that it should have been used, and we don't know that it was. And my favorite, possibly dead horse, I don't know if it's morbid yet, but it's probably, is Halima had Egwene literally under her thumbs for months, you know, Arengar, Halima. You going to tell me that the worst that she did to her was give her migraines? No. she could have laid any number of very subtle weaves of compulsion on her that will pop up down the road in the most annoying places. Why didn't she? She had all this opportunity to do it. Why would she not have? She's trying to get all these people in the Salazar Aes Sedai camp to do what she wants, trying to get somebody to kill Loghain. Why didn't she just lay a weave of compulsion on Egwene and have her give the command? I mean, there's a lot of strangenesses that pop up that could have been resolved as a compulsion thing and so far have not been. So I confess that I'm a little bit baffled. I mean, I'm wondering where this is all going to go, and I suspect that at the end we'll see some overwhelming reason, like, I'm rambling on so long. There was always the plot device that baffled me why, and even Rand hung a lantern on it, in literary terms, by pointing it out. You know, he always wondered why the Forsaken hadn't moved massive amounts of Trollocs through gateways and just dumped them on them. Well, because Shadowspawn cannot, we find out later, Shadowspawn cannot survive passing through a gateway log. So that was the limitation on that overwhelming power that the bad guys had. So are we going to see some sort of a thing with compulsion that's going to say, oh, well, obviously that's why she didn't do it, we just didn't know that.
I mean, that's definitely possible. The other thing with compulsion to remember, and, you know, Egwene actually does have some experience with it because of Nynaeve capturing Mogedion. One of the things they do mention is that, you know, the stronger your will, you know, your own personal willpower, the easier it is for you to break, or the harder it is for compulsion to take hold. We know Egwene is horribly strong-willed. I mean, it's what makes her, you know, one of the things that makes her a really great Ammerlin is that she, you know, literally, if she has her idea, she's going to stick to it, and that's going to be the end of that, so...
Yeah, and
you know, it may just be that, you know, Halima has tried, you know, to at least soften her to it, you know, and maybe she's been somewhat successful, and maybe she's tried and failed, but we'll have to see how that goes.
Maybe the headaches weren't an end in themselves, but just a byproduct of her trying to compel her.
I mean, it's certainly possible. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. Anyway, I don't think it's going to be probably a Raffo, so... We will read and find out. So anyway, I think we should probably move on to the next chapter, number 25, entitled In Darkness. This one is from Sheriam's point of view and also Egwene's. It begins with Sheriam, who enters her tent and checks once again to make sure that her treasure has not returned. She silently thanks Ramonda that Halima is gone at last. Chessa still keeps Egwene's tent neat. Sheriam joined her friends, quote-unquote, solely for power. She has no interest in the last battle or the Chosen. Suddenly, she senses a woman of great strength outside her tent. A black figure enters and Sheriam makes obeisance. Is that how you pronounce that? I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway. The figure says that Egwene must be deposed and that the Teleron Riad meetings must end and end now. Sheriam explains that the hall has many dream Teron Riad, and she truthfully says that there are 20, 18 for the hall, one for her, and one other that Lyanna had when she was captured. And the mysterious figure orders Sheriam to steal all of them. She has 3 days, and she will lose a finger or toe for each one she misses. The figure opens a gateway to the halls of the White Tower and vanishes. We shift then to Egwene's point of view, where we see that Cian is speaking with Egwene in Egwene's tiny cell. It is now 2 days since Elida beat and imprisoned her. The Red Sisters, Caryandra and Patrindra, stand guard outside. Several of the sisters have come to talk with them. Cian confirms that Elida will indeed be tried for breaking tower law, but nothing that she did is severe enough for her to be removed from the Ammerlin seat, unfortunately. Remembering what happened to Lyanna, Egwene asks if the Dark One is still causing evil changes in the White Tower, and Cian confirms that they are getting worse. After Cian leaves, Egwene sits in the darkness of her cell, knowing that she must still resist somehow. So we find a couple of things in this chapter, is that this pretty much confirms that it was Halima Arangar, the one feeding Sheriam, and also that Sheriam is actually Black Aja, which is the first time that we actually know for sure that that's true.
Yes, also it's very strongly implied that because the figure gateways to the White Tower, that the one who has visited her is in fact Mysana.
I think that's very likely. I'm not going to rule out the possibility that there's another Forsaken periodically lurking around the White Tower, but I think that would, you know, in this case, probably the obvious conclusion is the right one. let's hope. And we talked about this a minute ago, but actually the twists and turns of this series tends to make you so suspicious and paranoid that you start looking for a twist in every single thing that happens. But it can't always be the case. Sometimes things are what they are.
Yeah. I was a little, you know, creeped out, of course, by, you know, oh, you got 20 fingers.
I know.
It's
I know.
Like, and you think to yourself, it's like, okay, yes, well, that's motivating on a creepy, oh, look, how are you going to explain that if you miss... You're an Aes Sedai. I've lost a finger. I've got the finger right here. Maybe I should go to my sister Aes Sedai and have it healed. I mean, you, come on.
Oh, look, I just woke up and it fell off.
Yeah, I know. Seriously.
I'm wondering if, you know, when Perrin cut off the hand of that Aiel that they were questioning with the axe, they weren't able to heal that, even though the hand was right there. Why couldn't they just reattach that with the power? That made no sense to me. I mean, I can understand with Rand's hand being blasted off, the hand's destroyed, you can't grow it back. But, I mean, if you can just, you know, re-knit flesh and heal massive wounds and, you know, cure heart conditions and all kinds of other things, I mean, you're changing the flesh in such a way that it didn't seem to me like reattaching something that was cut off would be that big of a stretch.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I mean, with Perrin's thing, I specifically think it was a matter of he didn't want the hand reattached. You know, he wanted
he told the Aes Sedai that was, and I'd forgotten who it was, he told her immediately to heal the stump.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, it was more the threat of taking away everything that made the Aiel dangerous. His idea is like, I'll take off a hand, and if you don't answer my questions, I'll take off another hand, and I'll take off your feet, and I'll leave you sitting so that everybody can laugh at the poor Aielman who can't do anything.
Oh, I agree with his motivation there, but didn't, maybe I'm remembering it incorrectly, but didn't the Aes Sedai that was in the tent gasp, that can't be healed, I can't heal that?
It might have been. I thought it's been a while since I've read that segment, so...
That was in Knife of Dreams, wasn't it?
It was in, yes, Knife of Dreams, because shortly thereafter is when Perrin leaves the axe behind.
Right. Let me look for that, because that's actually kind of... It's not critical to this read-through, but I think it's kind of important in a way, but not for now. So I'll leave that for a search for later. It seemed like there was something in the chapter with Egwene that tugged at my consciousness, but I can't remember it now.
Well, it's the beginning of Egwene in a box scene, which parallels Rand's earlier captivity on orders from Elida.
That's true. It's true, but she certainly doesn't go crazy like he did. It wasn't quite as severe a captivity either, although she was beaten. She wasn't... I mean, really, basically, they tortured Rand nonstop by doubling him up in this tiny box where he couldn't even move with his muscles cramping and the heat and everything else. I mean, basically, Rand's agony never ended through the entire imprisonment. In a way, at least, she's sitting in the darkness, but she's not, you know, she's hurting from her bruises, but she's not, you know, still undergoing pain from continuing, you know, physical difficulties.
No, but true. But I mean, at the same time, her situation isn't much better than his. Yes, he was completely doubled over and, you know, couldn't move because of the size of the chest that he was placed in and that. But I mean, I think she reflects that she can touch, you know, all of the walls of her cell just by stretching her hand out. I mean, it is also a very, very, very small cell.
Yeah.
You know,
and what does that say about the Aes Sedai that they have cells like that in the White Tower?
Well, I wonder if they originally were cells. I wonder if they didn't come to be used for that. It might have just been, hey, here's a convenient small little place for a really small storage nook.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea that the Aes Sedai would need dungeons at all.
I know. That's what I'm saying. I mean, when you construct something with cells and, as you say, dungeons, you know, that says something about the person doing the constructing, and it, that would kind of keep me out, knowing that the Aes Sedai expected to have, I mean, obviously they expected to have some problems with the Aes Sedai. They have open cells where somebody could be held, you know, with shields on them and so forth and so on, and probably, you know, false dragons or channeling men or whatever that need to be confined until they can be tried or whatever, but you know, still, you know, the idea that they really needed dark, tiny cells like that, yeah, it's kind of creepy. It's sort of like Julin, or no, it's sort of like Matt's reflecting when they were in the Stone of Tyr, he and Julin, and he just didn't like what that said about the Lords of Tyr, that they had a fast, convenient, secret stairway to go right to the dungeons without having to go out of their way. I'm like, what does that say about them?
Yeah,
not
definitely.
Sure I want to meet anybody like that. Oh, God.
Yeah, it was also kind of nice that it at least made a show of trying to work towards justice by actually trying Elaina.
Mm.
They pretty much said, well, you know, she's going to be censured, but whoop-de-doo. But I mean,
yeah.
You know, it at least shows that Elaina has very little control over the Hall. And that, you know, she's not the truly iron-fisted tyrant that everybody expected her to be. I mean, it really is just beginning to show that as a leader, she's incompetent.
Yeah. Well, including all the Arryn's beatings and all the other things that have happened to her have diminished her in a lot of ways. I mean, it hasn't necessarily broken her, but it has certainly diminished her authority and caused her to go off all crazy on people, you know, losing it, beating somebody with the power in front of all the sitters. You know, how moronic is that? You know, I mean, there's no way any Amelin would ever think that they could get away with something like that. It shouldn't even have happened, and she should have been stopped. The fact that the sitters really didn't do very much during the whole thing was pretty indicative of how far the actual White Tower has sunk under Elaina's rule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Egwene's certainly going to have her work cut out for her getting, you know, the pride and dignity of the tower back to what it was. I mean, they basically just became a chaotic mass of idiots in a lot of ways. I'm sure there were a lot of them that were just standing aside, but then, you know, what does that say about them either? The Aes Sedai are supposed to be, you know, the movers and shakers, you know, the puppet masters, the people who keep order in the world and keep wars from breaking out, and they're supposed to be the servants of all, and they do that by protecting everyone, basically. You know, and then here they've allowed themselves and their internal affairs to degenerate to the point where it's an unbelievable mess. I mean, not only is the tower broken, but what was left of it in the White Tower was a joke. That nobody would stand up to that, to me, was beyond belief. And I suppose you can say that all the ones that probably would have stood up, you know, fled to Saladar, but what does that say about them, too, when you think about it? I mean, if you have your government basically going insane and overthrown and everything, I mean, is your first reaction to flee the country and just, oh, well, I'll just start over?
Yeah.
I don't know. The awe and mystery of the Aes Sedai has been so far diminished, except for Egwene. And I sort of feel like the wise ones. I mean, I started out just thinking they were so awesome and cool and admiring them so much, and now it's like so many of them are just a joke. It really saddens me and disappoints me, because I really wanted to like the Aes Sedai the way they were originally presented. I mean, they were a little over the top, you know, the manipulators of everybody, but, you know, I thought they were pretty cool. And now it's like there's only a few of them that are still pretty cool, and I'm hoping they can get that back.
Yeah.
This is like finding that, you know, Tuon is, you know, secretly going to go out and renounce being empress and become a Gleeman or something. You know, it just does, it bugs me. Anyway, enough of that.
That pretty much wraps up chapter 25. We'll continue on with chapter 26, A Crack in the Stone. This one begins in Avienda's point of view. Everyone is preparing to depart for Bandar Aban. To Avienda, it is mostly chaos. Bashir's troops are more orderly than the rest. She's still undergoing useless work as punishment, dripping water from one bucket into another. As she does this, Min comes up and tries to start a conversation. She completely misses how embarrassing that this easy and sheerly useless work is to Avienda. Avienda knows of the attack by Samarog the night before. She felt Rand's anguish and raised the alarm, which is how everyone managed to finally get around the secrecy with which Samarog was acting. Min is worried that they might fight over Rand, and ends up doing one of her usual knife flourishes. Avienda, in typical Aiel fashion, thinks to herself at how foolish that is. You know, it is similar in a way to Tom Merlin, and how he used to twirl his knives. It really puzzles her that anyone should do that, because economically, in battle, it's a useless skill. Min comments almost one too many time on Avienda's chore, and eventually Avienda just snaps. She storms off through the camp until she finds Amys, Bear, and Melanie. She says that she refuses to take orders from them anymore if they have nothing left to teach her. Bear and Melanie actually laugh at this. It turns out that Avienda has finally passed her last test, demanding to be accepted as an equal rather than meekly accepting her role as a student. The declaration makes one a wise one. This is actually the reason that Savannah was accepted as a wise one, and not just immediately shunned by everybody. Avienda will now travel to Cold Rock's Hold, then following that will run to Ruidine, where she will traverse the glass columns and fully take her place amongst the wise ones. She walks through the gateway to the Aiel Waste. She exults. Her honor has thus been restored. We then shift to Ramonda's point of view. Shemarin is in Ramonda's tent, being questioned by Shemarin, Samwan, Leanne, Sherim, and Magla. Shemarin answers all of their questions without complaint and tells them of the water gate that she used to escape the city. By the statues of Elayon Al-Londarin and her warders. Ramonda and the others are shocked that Elida had the audacity to demote her from Aes Sedai to accepted, especially for such a minor offense. Ramonda still wishes that Egwene would return to stifle Lelaine's plotting. They met with her in Teleronriad last night, and know she is now imprisoned, but still refusing rescue. As the questioning continues, Ramonda notices a lump moving under the floor of the tent. She's horribly kind of disgusted by this, the idea that it might be some sort of insect or small rodent, and we kind of get a glimpse into the idea that Ramonda's a bit obsessive-compulsive. As she's minding this small lump in the floor, the canvas of the tent rips and a huge roach scuttles across the floor. In a moment, there is a flood of roaches following the first, and the sisters all shriek. Rurik and Burin burst into the tent, but stare helplessly at the vermin. Everyone scrambles out of the tent, and Lelaine asks if Ramonda had anything that she values in the tent. Ramonda channels fire and torches her tent and everything inside, saying nothing that I would want to keep now. Magla says the roaches are a kind only seen in Shara. Ramonda thinks Egwene is right. The end is coming soon. She wonders if she could make herself bow to Elida in order to make the White Tower whole for the last battle.
That's another one of the creepiest scenes to me. But I like so many people, have the horror of insects like that. Well, to sort of discuss the last chapter first, I believe, is the most obvious example to the Saladar Aes Sedai that the pattern is really unraveling. And, you know, the other bubbles of evil that they experienced were fairly mild in comparison to this, but I think this is really driven it home to them finally. But unfortunately, Ramonda comes to the wrong conclusion with this, wondering if instead of sticking behind Egwene is the answer, she's wondering if she can make herself submit to Elida in order to make the White Tower whole. Wrong conclusion, Ramonda.
Yeah, definitely. And when it's interesting, I mean, like I said, we brought up earlier in the previous chapter how, you know, everyone is just amazingly shocked that not only did Elida have the power to just demote her out of hand for almost nothing, but also that, you know, she accepts it. And, you know, it was really just one of those weird things. It is nice that they kind of slipped in, well, how did you get out of the tower? All of the gate hounds are being watched and, you know, everything, because that's going to come into play, the mentioning of the water gate, by the statue of Elion Al-Ladaran, which is interesting. The notes here from Encyclopedia Watt say that it is a curiously familiar name, but all that we really have on her is that she is one of the early Merlins that was raised from the green. There's nothing really specific. I guess it's just there are a number of certain common elements in connection with her and various other Aes Sedai and royalty that have existed over the over the course of the series. Not necessarily familiar that we should know it, but familiar in that, you know, it has an awl, it has, you know, a kind of lawn and randish kind of bit. It ends in Rin, which a lot of, you know, Two Rivers names have that sort of kind of common ending, especially with the awl in front of it. And Elion is like, you know, Elias and Elaine and Eliana. There's tons of varied names that are all kind of vaguely, phonetically similar.
I may be wrong on this, and I'm reluctant to spend the time to look it up, but it seems to me, wasn't Elaine the one in New Spring that tried to force, or actually did raise the Golden Crane and try to force Lon into supporting her for queen? Elaine, it's very familiar sounding to me, but then, I don't know. Well, I'm going to look it up real quick. I can't stand it. Actually, it would probably be an Encyclopedia Watt, wouldn't it?
Yeah, no, I actually looked up the name on Encyclopedia Watt, and it only says that she's an early Merlin who was raised from the green.
Yeah, but I mean, just the first name I thought was something very similar to that, the woman that was, I guess not. Never mind.
No, I mean, we've spent a good chunk of time talking about the second half of the chapter. I was so happy when we got to this point. I think from the beginning of Min's conversation with Avienda and mentioning how pointless it was and how Avienda could relax, it was sitting there as I was reading going, finally, Avienda's going to snap. She's going to have to snap at this. You know, because it seemed like from the very instant she said, oh, well, you know, what am I doing wrong? What am I being punished for? And they're like, you're not learning fast enough. It seemed directly to me, it's like, oh, they're just waiting for her to say, yeah, no. I'm not going to take this anymore, you know, either promote me or not. And, you know, it was so nice that it was like, it seemed the instant Min sat down, it's like, oh, she's going to mention it and it's going to push her over, which is good because it was kind of getting a little tiresome having, oh, Avienda point of view. Oh, look, she's doing useless work and she wonders why. It was kind of the repetition thing was getting just a bit much. And, we're taken aback, of course, again to the fact that Avienda is always going to think like a maiden. Even as a wise one, she's going to think like a maiden because that's, you know, that's how she was brought up. And, you know, the entire, you know, thinking that it's foolish for anybody to be twirling knives. Well, okay, yes, in combat, twirling knives is not effective. You know, there's no purpose to it at all. You know, the concept of twirling the knife is that you're out of combat and it's showing a certain amount of physical dexterity that is supposed to at least be impressive enough to say, yes, I can use a knife, I can use it effectively, and, you know, it's not meant to be something that, you know, I'm going to get into combat and I'm going to be like and swirling the knives around. That's just a little silly, you know. And yeah, it's like the convention you see in movies where someone goes to challenge someone to a duel and they walk up and they slap the person with their gloves. Well, I'm sorry if you've offended me or, you know, I've offended you and you start walking towards me with a glove, I'm going to pull out my dagger and I'm going to stab you. and it's going to, you're going to be dead before you can get to me with the glove. So it's like, you know,
the glove wasn't the attack. Yeah.
No, I mean I mean, it's all funny to do so, but no, in reality, you know, the glove was hurled to the ground at your feet, and it was your job to, you know, pick it up, to accept, or even, you know, to have someone else pick it up for you, and that person would usually be your second in a duel. So it is the idea that, yeah, Avienda misses the point of the gesture, but it serves to reaffirm for us that Avienda has a way of thinking, and that way is not going to be significantly altered even by going through training and becoming a wise one.
Well, even beyond that, it really points out the complete disconnect and lack of understanding that Avienda still has of Wetlander culture, even this, despite the fact that she's spent, I'm going to say probably nearly a year outside of the waste, traveling around with Wetlanders, trying to supposedly learn about their ways, because she knows that she's going to be, and she has known since almost the beginning that she was going to be inextricably tied to a Wetlander and needed to learn his customs as well as teach him and hers. Because the Aiel are all just so badass. They don't need to have little displays of dexterity and skill like that to impress one another. They just know they're all deadly to one extent or another. And, you know, for Avienda not to understand that this is a way that Wetlanders have of impressing somebody enough that they might not do something stupid like provoke an attack or a duel.
Yeah.
To me, it's just stupid that she just doesn't get this after all this time. It's just not that hard.
Well, yeah.
You know?
Well, and you mentioned that, you know, the Aiel don't really have it, but in some ways they do, kind of, because there are certain things that, you know, and I say we, but, you know, the Wetlanders see that Aiel do that is also just basically silly. Like, you know, I remember at one point, it might have been Gaul and it might have been just one of the other Aiel men. They do this thing where, like, they, you know, they jump up off of one foot and kick it as high in the air as they possibly can and come down landing on one foot. And, you know, it's supposed to be like this competition over, you know, height, and, you know, it's all part of, you know, some sort of cultural thing that people not familiar with it are just like, that's silly. Why would you do that?
Well, they were, you know, for one thing, when we saw them doing that, they were celebrating some big victory, you know. And so, and they're all drinking, you know, so these, I put that down to the fact that they were sort of like drinking games where people, you know, especially, forgive me, men, who tend to participate in kind of silly contests like that, you know, but I sort of saw that like, you know, almost like a festival atmosphere where you do things like, Wetlanders might do things like play tug of war or something like that, which is totally useless. It means nothing. It's just a game. It's just a fun little stupid game to kind of blow off some excess energy and have a good laugh. You know, there's actually no combat involved and no anything involved, you know, like a sack race or something like that. And I think that's sort of the ideal equivalent of that. But I don't think they just run around in the square, you know, randomly trying to impress their enemies by jumping up and, actually what they were jumping up and doing, one of those things was jumping up and kicking Culloden's head. It was definitely a victory celebration on that one time. And then, you know, the other thing was the one that Matt was so good at, throwing up the pieces of wood in the air and hitting them with a knife. You know, it's just, they're not above competitions and stuff like that, but it really isn't the same as what Min was doing.
Yeah.
You know, basically Tom and Min do that in order to try and dissuade somebody from doing something stupid.
Yeah.
You know, like in a bar or something like that. You really want to fight me? Look at this. Watch this. You know, might just be a little better than you.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, and I get that. It is more just the cultural aspect is that, you know, as much as they like to think that they are, you know, completely economic about everything, you know, the Aiel do have some things that they do that. You know, and like I said, it's taking nothing away from them. But, you know, it is just that point that she thoroughly misses the point with Min.
Yeah.
And it helps to further her irritation, which is, of course, what finally leads to her getting, you know, what she ultimately has been wanting. I don't know, you know, how, and once again, we've got the idea that, well, now that she's got regained her honor, she can actually stand to be with Rand again. You know, we know that Avienda's going to get pregnant with quadruplets, and that something would be weird about it. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I'm kind of wondering, it's like there's not a whole lot of time left in the series. Yes, there are two books, but at the same time, we really don't, you know, the last battle is literally tripping on our heels here, and
She didn't have 9 months. I don't think they have 9 months, too.
Well, Rand just has to be around to father the children. He doesn't have to be there for their birth.
Well, that's true, but then, I mean, I guess it depends on how much of A Memory of Light is going to take place after the last battle.
Hmm.
You know?
Well, and how alive Rand will be.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I think another odd thing is that we were talking about how Avienda just seems to sometimes stubbornly refuse to understand Outlander culture. Min's not much better on that account. She just doesn't want to be bothered to understand the Aiel. I mean, she thinks everything they do is pretty lame and really makes no secret of it, you know, and that explains how that she can sit there and not get how, you know, humiliating what Avienda is doing and just they're commenting on it. Why are you doing that? That doesn't make any sense. She ought to, by now, knowing that she's going to be inextricably tied to Avienda, and she's known that for a really long time, you know, you'd think with all of her studying and book learning and all that other stuff, you know, that she would spend 10 or 15 minutes trying to pick up a few Aiel customs so that she wouldn't offend her.
That's true. Well, it's also, you know, I guess you could possibly misread or, you know, read differently Min's actions as being more purposeful than unknowing. I'm going to doubt that immediately. But I will say it's possible to read that Min was purposefully kind of being insulting to Avienda in order to get her goat up so that Avienda would finally go and do what needs to be done. I mean, I will attribute that to that if I can look at it and go, Avienda's doing a bunch of silly work, and she really should have figured out by now that all it really is going to take is for her to stand up for herself to go, you know, that, you know, I have to assume somebody else could possibly be capable of it. But I will almost immediately discount it, saying that, you know, Min probably didn't realize it, but, you know, it just, I picture this horribly comic scene of, you know, Min coming up and sitting down, like, oh, I've been loading boxes onto wagons all day, I really wish I could soak my hands, you know, just entire Palmolive commercial almost, and...
Well, I'm going to sort of take the opposite thing from what I just said now that you mentioned that and say there's two actual ways to explain that. Either she actually could have been spending some time learning about the Aiel and realized that maybe she could help push Avienda over the edge, or she just could have had a viewing.
It's true.
You know,
not every viewing that Min has needs to be announced as what it is.
No, she sees all kinds of stuff that she never tells anybody. You know, so maybe she saw something here and decided that she needed to be, you know, part of the catalyst to push her into doing what she should have done months ago, weeks ago at least, according to the wise ones. The other thing that struck me as odd about this thing is that Avienda's going to travel to Coldrock's Hold and then run Rudian. Am I completely remembering it wrong, but didn't they all gather as groups, didn't they go to the slopes of Chandar above Rudian and then run down from Chandar into Rudian? They just, you know, basically walked back and forth from Chandar to Coldrox the last time. Why does she have to run?
I think that's partially just because, well, okay, here's the thing. Well, Chandar was the staging area for going into Rudian the first time. We don't actually know for a fact that you have to actually start there each time.
Oh, that's true. The wise ones do it twice. That's right.
And basically, the only reason they said Coldrox was because, I mean, they basically told her, it's like, you know, yeah, we already know, you already know what you're going to see when you go through there. Thanks a lot, Rand. I mean, we would really prefer that you do something, like at least to kind of preserve that tradition of there needing to be an effort in order to do it. So I think, you know, the idea of, you know, well, just travel to Cold Rocks, it's as good as any other distance, and get there fast and get back fast, because, you know, frankly, we don't want to lose you for the last two books of the series.
Yeah, really, while you're running to Iridian. And this to me is sort of the idea of Tuan taking a ship back to Shandar. There's not enough time for her to do that and come back and do anything meaningful, you know. Somehow she's going to need to travel. I don't know why they just didn't have her travel to Shandar or like you say, Iridian itself. But then again, they're probably trying to keep some shreds of the customs that Rand has ripped into pieces.
Yeah. So, I mean...
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I don't think really that Cold Rocks was all that very far away either. So it's not like they're giving her extra or less, really. I mean, I think it's almost a conveniently equivalent distance.
I think it's a couple of days, at least, of, you know, walking with the, you know, Kaishine and the wagons and all that. It took him a few days when Rand was doing it. He fretted nonstop about the amount of time it took him to get everywhere.
Yeah,
I think it was going to take him a month to get to Alcar Dal, and I think about half of that time was taken up in going to Cold Rock.
That's true, but I mean, at the same
stand first, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's true, but at the same time, it is also that, you know, Rand is also traveling with a bunch of, you know, horse and wagons and, you know, a huge train of people. I mean, Avienda's on her own, and, you know, One Aiel on her own is a lot faster than, you know, any amount of any other stuff that could possibly...
That's true. I guess the other point that we should probably lightly touch on is the custom of someone basically standing up and demanding to be accepted as something. And it mentions in the note that that explains why the wise ones are the Shahido, and other clans grudgingly accepted Savannah as a wise one. But my problem with that is that Savannah was never an apprentice. I mean, how can anybody, just any Aiel, stand up and be demanded to be accepted as a wise one without being an apprentice? That still doesn't make sense to me. But there you go.
Well, I mean, I think that was literally that. I mean, Savannah was an amazingly interesting creature because she was more political than almost every other Aiel that we've seen, and being that much more politic, she was closer to being, you know, a Wetlander. At the same time, it was the idea that, I mean, I think literally it was only this that, you know, that allowed them to go, okay, we really can't just laugh at you and send you away, you know. I mean, it was like amongst everybody but the Shahido, she was, you know, it was like, oh God, we have to deal with Savannah, you know, she's really not really a wise one. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I don't know. I guess we'll just have to put it down to the fact that we never really understand everything about the Aiel, and probably never will, because surely there aren't going to be enough more books, you know, to really give us any more insight than we already have. And the Aiel culture has changed so dramatically already that maybe it doesn't even matter anymore. I mean, a lot of their customs they're going to preserve, but a lot of them are just going to be overturned. So, I took you to a place you probably didn't want to go. Okay, so the next one's mine. Okay, well, I think that'll wrap it up for chapter 26. Moving on to 27, which is entitled The Tipsy Gelding. It's got to be one of the cutest chapter titles in all of The Wheel of Time. And this one starts out from Matt's point of view, and we enter with him riding Pips into the small town of Hinderstaff, town somewhat smaller than Barilon, accompanied by Jolene, Edesina, Teslin, Glarix, and Tamana's Tom, Harnan, Villarn, and three other soldiers. Aludra, Agiana, Mathura, Noel, and Oliver have stayed behind, outside of the town. Matt refuses to think about Tuan. Tom is reading his letter from Moraine yet again, and Bael Domon will lead them to the Tower of Genje in just a few weeks, where he wonders if they will run into Lanfear. They are actually heading into Camelin, but they may stop at the town of Four Kings on the way. Matt then thinks of Rand and sees an image of him slumped in a chair, missing a hand. and is somewhat startled by that. Tom then quotes a poem on the Wheel of Time written by Doriala, a queen of Aradal. She had visited this area called the Splintered Hills near Eagle's Reaches in Coromanda. They round a bend and find the town just as Vannon said it would be. Master Roydell said that the road will eventually lead them into Andor. Once in town, Baraldin, the mayor, welcomes them, but tells them that they must leave before nightfall. The Aes Sedai and three Red Arms enter the finest inn in town. The dice start rattling in Matt's head, never a good sign. And he then sees a man showing a piece of paper to Baraldin, but Baraldin just shakes his head. Matt and Tomanis go into an average inn, the Tipsy Gelding. Matt begins systematically losing his money. After losing his pocket money, Harnan and Dalarn bring in a chest of gold, and Matt bets it against a wagon of provisions. Baraldin says it is too late, they must leave, but Mardry says that he has a wagon and team and that there is still time. It's getting dark, but Matt makes a decision to stay, and the dice in his head stop rolling. When the wagon is loaded with supplies, the mayor makes his toss, but Matt still wins. The mayor yells at them to leave and never return. As they go out to the wagon, there is no one on the street, and then they hear screaming. Ooh.
Yeah, this is, of course, a setup chapter, and it is one of the... I don't know if it's just my penchant for plot or what have you, but it did kind of seem fairly obvious almost what was going to happen here. They make a few notes that we shall notice. Number one, the three Red Arms that accompany the Aes Sedai are not heard from at this point in time. They don't reappear to my best knowledge in the next chapter. And we don't ever really get any concept of what happened to them at all.
Red shirts.
Yeah. possibly, and if so, I'm very sorry for them. Another interesting thing that we do notice here is that Matt wants to be losing money. I mean, it is part of his plan that his luck should run poorly, and it does, which is unusual, and which is, again, something that slightly suggests that Taverin, if they are conscious of it, may actually have some control over how they affect the pattern by being Taverin. The note from Encyclopedia Watt is Matt is beginning to have some control over his luck, winning or losing as necessary. It's also reflected back from the 11th chapter of Knife of Dreams, in which Matt reflects that he really needs to lose right now because he's been winning too much, and he does. So it is one of those things that I'm wondering if we're now seeing that going to come out, that if you are very strongly Taverin, that you may actually be able to start influencing the pattern specifically just by being Taverin.
Well, we've seen Rand do that a couple of chapters back, where he's actually bending the pattern around him. You know, Matt's luck is sort of a separate little issue that I think comes from other sources besides merely being Taverin, because Perrin and Rand do not have the luck. You know, I mean, they may be lucky to a certain extent, as we know that, well, Rand in particular, we know that channelers were noted in New Spring for being unusually lucky, but it's more of a survival luck rather than gambling luck like Matt's. I think Matt's comes from other areas, and we speculated on this in previous podcasts. I think it has to do more with the dagger from Shatter Logoth than anything else, because he even reflects that his luck started after he got the ruby tip dagger. But the idea that they can control the pattern themselves is, that's a pretty major concept and is going to be crucial to giving them an edge in the last battle. I mean, if Matt and Rand and Perrin all begin to realize that they can actually purposefully bend the pattern around them rather than just being pushed and pulled by it, well, that's one serious, serious edge. And what if all three of the boys together combined to distort the pattern in their favor? I mean, we're talking some serious power here.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, it might even be so much that they could just tear the pattern and tear the fabric of, the all together.
It's very possible. I mean, it's I think it's another reason why Moraine had to revise when she found, you know, three Tavarin where she was expecting only one. Is that, you know, we've already seen that when you know, Matt and Rand both went into the doorway, the redstone twisted doorway to the fins, that the, you know, the entire area started to destabilize. You know, it was just too much, and they had to leave because, yeah, that's how it was. And so, I mean, it's very possible that, you know, the three of them together could have enough power to them that, you know, they could cause great damage, but at the same time, they might also be able to alter the flow of the pattern enough that leads to an ultimate victory.
Yeah. And I don't really want to present this as a crazy theory, but it has popped into my head on a couple of times. You know, Luz Theron has made the reference to we three, and I automatically assumed that it was Rand, Luz Theron, and Morden. But what if Luz Theron, apparently being the artifact that he is and basically a part of Rand, what if he was referring to the other two boys as Tavarin, as what would they actually be able to do together?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really see, because I don't think it can happen, that the three boys would actually merge into one, because we know for one thing that Matt survives as a separate person afterward because Jordan was planning to write a book about him and Tuon. So I infer from that there will not be physical merging, you know, a la Slayer and Luke or Mortis and Padon Fain or any of that sort of thing. But what if they can sort of metaphysically merge together during the last battle to function as one unit? I mean, will they need to or not? I mean, it actually would probably be less exciting to have the three of them functioning as a unit than have all three of them fighting their parts of the battle separately. But I just have to throw it out there as a possibility, merely because it ran across my feverish brain for a moment. And I just don't know how this is going to turn out. I you know, we've been guessing for 20 years here, and I freely admit that for all my study of the Wheel of Time series over these years and my immersion in it, I'm not Robert Jordan or Brandon Sanderson, either one. They continually amaze me with the depth of creativity that they have in this series, and particularly Robert Jordan, because obviously Brandon has his own set of, you know, amount of creativity and creating his own worlds and everything else, and because of that he's able to finish this series appropriately. But Robert Jordan had such a depth of vision in creating this world. I freely admit I am not capable of figuring out where he's going with some of the things that he's doing. I'll probably be massively surprised rather than, I knew that. You know, I don't think I'm going to be able to pat myself on the back too much for figuring out what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's definitely something we're just going to have to read and see.
Read and find out, I know. One thing I want to go back to briefly is that we mentioned them in passing, the Red Arms, and I made the little comment that they were like red shirts in Star Trek, who are the throwaway characters that invariably get killed, and when you see a red shirt go on to, you know, shore patrol or something like that, they're pretty much going to be toast. And actually, do you know the exact number of red shirts that died in the original series?
No, I don't.
59. How's that for a geek? Anyway, I wonder if that wasn't a sort of a little subtle homage to Star Trek, because we know that Robert Jordan has done that, you know, for other series that he enjoyed and admired. You know, he had an inn named the Nine Rings, and Rand saw it and thought, wow, that had always been one of his favorite books when he was a child, although we never ever see a copy of the book, The Nine Rings. It was always one of his favorite tales, I guess. And, you know, we see that as a little homage to Lord of the Rings. And a few other areas where he's done that before. I'm just kind of wondering offhandedly if that was a little connection there. Because that does really run through the Red Arms pretty quickly. He lost like two-thirds of them when he went to Abadar.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. The other thing is just that, I mean, we don't give their names, we don't see their bodies, we don't, you know, they disappear. I mean, it was kind of as if, oh, whoops. didn't keep track of those particular threads.
I know, and he was always upset when he would lose men. You know, he's like Rand in that. He hates to lose people. He doesn't beat himself up over it to the same extent, but that Matt and Perrin do. I mean, that Rand and Perrin do. But he does worry about it. And I can't believe. I mean, Matt's the kind of guy who would, you know, be sort of like the Marine commander. You know, no man left behind. I can't see him just walking away and leaving them. It was either a mistake, or he knows, but we don't yet.
Yeah.
So maybe they're going to pop up again in some other spectacular fashion. I don't know. It's one of the little weirdities.
Yeah. Well, following hard on the heels of Chapter 27, we move directly into Chapter 28, Night in Hinderstap. The villagers of Hinderstap have all gone completely crazy and are trying to kill everyone in sight. Matt pulls Pips away from the tipsy gelding, and he, Talmanis, Harnan, and Dalarn try to flee, leaving the wagon and the gold likewise behind. Dalarn is dragged from his horse and badly wounded, but Matt saves him. Tom joins them, and they ride to the inn where the Aes Sedai are. On the first floor, the cook is the only one left alive, and Matt kills him when he attacks them. Master Tobrud, the innkeeper, is dead as well. They make it up the stairs and find Jolene, Edesina, Teslin, Blerick, and Fenn, along with two bound serving girls who are struggling to get loose. Downstairs, Edesina heals Dalarn, and they all ride out of town, taking the serving girls with them, and camp on a nearby hillside to wait for dawn. Hours later, Matt is moping that the Dark One is still chasing him. The golem is somewhere out there. Murdrel and Dark Friends, too. Tom shows Matt a picture he got at another inn, which is an image of Matt himself. Someone, it is said, is looking for him in a village to the north, a woman. Suddenly, the two serving girls just vanish. Matt and Tom ride back toward Hinderstap in order to investigate. At the fine inn, Matt recognizes the cook that he himself killed. He thinks they are all ghosts until they reach the spot of intense fighting the night before and see absolutely no blood on the ground. Baraldin comes up and offers an explanation. This has been going on for several months, apparently, since just before the Feast of Abram. Everyone goes crazy at dusk, killing everyone they can. In the morning, they all wake up in their own beds. Baraldin dreamed of killing Old Man Gherkin, only to find him alive the next day. Samory, the cooper, had relatives that came and visited. They were murdered that night and then became permanent residents of Hinderstap. Matt asks him about the picture. Baraldin told Laedron that they will not sell the visitors out, despite there being a reward offered. The picture of another man with golden eyes came from an inn called the Shaken Fist in the village of Trastare. Matt rides Pips and leads the wagon horse with their food and gold as they leave Hinderstap. Tom thinks it is sad. There's something wrong in the world, and the pattern is unraveling.
Absolutely, the pattern is unraveling. I have to say, I really never thought we'd see zombies. In the real time. Zombies! Ah!
Yeah, this chapter, the summary doesn't do it justice. This chapter is very tense, and anyone who has seen, you know, 28 Days or 28 Days Later, or even some of the more recent Dawn of the Dead remakes, are going to recognize, you know, just how, you know, creepy the insane mass of people just out to kill and sheerly mindless aside from that can be. Like, this summary leaves out that Jolene nearly takes Matt's head off with a fireball the instant he, like, steps into the doorway, you know, and, you know, he kind of yells at them for it, but, you know, everything is seemingly normal. You know, Matt's just one, and, you know, you can see the sun sink over the horizon, and then screams start, and you can imagine, you know, Edicina and Jolene and all of them are just sitting down in their baths. I mean, when Matt and the others come upon them, I mean, they're in bath towels, you know, hurling fireballs everywhere, and Tomanus, you know, is leering at, you know, one of the Aes Sedai. I actually think it's Jolene, and it's just like, oh, seriously? You know, I mean, everything just goes completely bonkers in a matter of seconds, and, you know, it's kind of a, you know, it's just kind of one of those things that just is not terribly expected. I mean, I really do think that it was meant to give Matt a chance to do something dangerous and heroic that we hadn't yet seen, but not detract too much from the fact that I think they're, through this novel, they are kind of repositioning Matt to contain more of the comic relief that he had in the very beginning of the series, that over the course of the middle five or six books, he seemed to have lost a little bit. But yeah, first, when I read this chapter, one of the first things I thought was, oh, it's 28 days later. Except that, spoiler warning, not everybody was alive and awake again after the next day. One of the other things that is lost in this, Tom goes on to continue his musing about what's going on here. And, you know, his supposition is that the pattern is unraveling, and the pattern itself is a function of structure. So at night, the Dark One, when his power is greater, is exerting more control over humanity. I mean, the concept might be that if the Dark One completely breaks free, this is what he's able to do to everyone in the world. You know, just make everyone go insane and start killing everyone else. And so, you know, he's exerting more control. This village goes completely berserk in a way that's not supposed to happen according to the pattern. And when dawn comes and the light reasserts itself, the pattern kind of snaps back into place and does like this real soft reset in order to fix what shouldn't have happened the night before. And unfortunately, it has the unintended result that as this pattern of break, reset happens, that it catches this village in a permanent cycle of nothing can get done. And it is, as Tom reflects, very, very sad that, you know.
Yeah, not only that, but not only are the villagers trapped in this endless loop, but the Cooper's relatives who came to visit, who were murdered, became permanent residents as well. And so other people can come in and be trapped, unlike Matt and his band, most of whom were able to walk away because they weren't killed. Again, we don't know what happened to the three red arms that accompanied the Aes Sedai, and the notes here mention that they're nowhere to be seen and no one seems to miss them, which is extremely odd. I think that maybe either that was a mistake or they'll pop up in some spectacular fashion later on. One thing that kind of surprised me about this is that the advent of a Taviran into the village made no difference. You would think that that might in itself be enough to break the cycle or bend it around him. And we were just talking about how the boys are learning to manipulate their Taviran-ness and manipulate the pattern, but Matt apparently hasn't figured it out except for his luck. Because I'm wondering if it wouldn't be possible for him to, you know, to break the cycle of, you know, loop and reset that's going on here in Hinderstaff if he had yet achieved a little bit more awareness of his actual power.
It's possible. I mean, you know, one of the other things that I thought when reading this chapter is that Dalarn, you know, he's horribly wounded. He's very badly. And, you know, I guess it's just, you know, the movies that I've seen that, you know, click in my head. You know, I was wondering because it seems that even once he's healed, he's not terribly as good as he used to be. You know, at least that was my impression in reading. And I kind of half wondered that it's like, well, what happens if he dies now, even though he's away from Hinderstaff? Will he wake up in Hinderstap? You know, and, you know, it's sort of a dangerous concept, but, you know, at the same time, it was one of those things that I couldn't help but think, because, I mean, he was very, very badly wounded, and for some reason, I want to say, and I haven't read this portion again recently, I want to say that, you know, afterwards, he was, like, either sick, or, you know, he might have had a fever, or it didn't seem that he was as well as he should have been for having received healing.
Mm.
You know, and it's just...
Well, it says that he was too weak to ride on his own after the healing, so possibly it was just the weakness of standard Aes Sedai healing. I mean, obviously Jolene doesn't know the new weaves, so...
It's possible, yeah, it's true.
I don't know. I mean, we're kind of used to Nynaeve's fabulous healing, and they don't even convulse or anything, really. They just get healed, you know. And a lot of the healing that we've seen done, too, has been on Rand, and Rand is just so tough and hard anymore. Nothing phases him when he's healed. Mm-hmm. Perrin either. Perrin seems to shred it off pretty easily, too, anymore.
I was going to say that, you know, during the entire battle, there's also a lot of difference from where we pick up. You have this idea that, you know, an attack's going on at night, and, you know, there are street lamps and stuff, but, you know, Hinderstap's a very small village, and nobody bothers lighting lamps anymore, because, you know, the village knows that it's all going to go crazy and whatnot, so why bother wasting the oil, you know, to light street lamps if, you know, nobody's going to remember anything, and it's all just going to be an orgy of death. You know, why even bother doing things like that? So they're not being just patrolled, they're not just being chased through the street by rabid people and that. They're being chased through the dark, you know, with only, you know, moon and starlight to even give them a semblance of where they're going and, you know, what's going on. And, you know, and suddenly you've got this mass of not just people who are crazy, but these, you know, shadows convulsing around you that are, you know, closing in on all sides and just inhumanly strong, and, you know, the darkness is creeping in and compounding, and it really is, you know, kind of a frightening chapter when you're reading through it.
Yeah. I kind of wonder, you know, since these people are bound to the village and can't get too far away, I mean, apparently they can go as far as they can go during daylight, but... Then they're popped back at night. The serving girls, when did they vanish? Did they vanish at dawn?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they can't apparently leave, or they would. So how are they managing to farm and get supplies in? I mean, I suppose people come through during the day and maybe bring goods, but most villages have to be pretty self-supporting. How does that interfere with their, you know, ability to function as a village? Nobody can go outside of the village less than a day's ride away to bring anything that they can't make themselves. It seems like eventually the village will die.
Yeah, I mean, it's very possible that might, you know, be the case. I'm wondering a little bit of what happens if you take someone extremely far away from the village, like if you were to channel a gateway to, you know, Tyr, or, you know, the Borderlands, or Seanchan, you know, if, you know, will the effect still persist? You know, how do we necessarily know? I mean, other than just being that, you know, we can't ride more than a day's out of the village. Well, you know, how local is this phenomenon?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Again, that leads me, you know, around to, you know, what happens if, you know, Dalarn dies now. You know, yes, he's very far away now. You know, is he going to suddenly, mysteriously get teleported back to, you know, Hinderstap? Is he, you know, is he free from infection because, you know, he was healed? You know, what's going on there?
Well, the serving girls weren't, say, compelled to return or walk back. They just vanished and reappeared in the village. I don't know how local that effect would be. Like you say, if somebody took them by gateway over to Shara or something like that, would that, they might still pop back, or they might not. We don't know. It makes me think of the village that appeared and melted into the ground. I mean, if this goes on long enough and the pattern in this area tears enough, will the village just be destroyed? And then I start wondering about other things, like what if all the villagers during the day left the village and burned it to the ground? Would it reappear during the night and reset and everything be as it was? What if they killed each other during the day? What if somebody took their life during the day? Would they then just be back at night again anyway? I mean, there are a lot of questions about this, and maybe the Aes Sedai have some answers, but I don't. So we may never know. There may be one of these chapters, this chapter may contain some of those things that Robert Jordan just said in his notes, this does not get resolved. Obviously it's an effect of the pattern disintegrating and the last days being imminent, but, you know, the questions and the ramifications are pretty astounding, really, when you think about it.
Yeah.
And then, to kind of go on to a lighter note, one of my little favorite scenes in this whole thing, you alluded to when you were talking about the Aes Sedai in their bathrobes, you know, channeling to try and hold off all these zombie-like people coming after them. I've got to read this little short section here for Jolene. They come up the stairs to see Jolene, and she's wearing only her enveloping white dressing robe. Her pretty face calm, her black hair slick and wet, hanging down over the front of her right shoulder. The robe was parted slightly at the top, giving a hint of what hid inside. Tamanis whistled softly. She's not a woman, Tamanis, Matt whispers warningly. She's an Aes Sedai. Don't think of her as a woman. I'm trying, Matt, Tamanis said, but it's hard. He hesitated, then asked, burn me. Be careful or she will, Matt said, tugging his hat down slightly in front. In fact, she nearly did that to me just a moment ago. I just think that's really funny. These poor guys are traveling with these really, actually, except for Tesla and Jolene and Edesina, are really pretty gorgeous, you know. And yet they think of them as something completely different. They don't even want to think of them as women. You know, they're almost not human. It's pretty funny, but then Talmanis just can't resist, you know, her womanly charms. I wonder if Talmanis is going to end up being somebody's warder, personally. He's not nearly afraid enough of Aes Sedai.
Yeah.
And Jolene's green, isn't she? She's got, yeah, Blerick and Finn. Edesina's yellow, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe there's going to be a little something going on here between Jolene and Talmanis. Talmanis would make a great warder. You know, he really would. But then after the last hour, Green's going to need multiple warders. I guess there'll always be some danger, but I don't see, if the last battle comes and goes, that sort of eliminates a lot of the res and death ray for the Green Aja, being the Battle Aja, preparing for the last battle. You know, we've seen the reds, now they're repurposed, you know, maybe the greens are going to have to repurpose too.
Yeah.
Lots of changes for everybody. Something for everyone.
I think it'll pretty much wrap up this particular episode. We, of course, would like to thank everyone for listening, and thanks again to Encyclopedia Watt for providing us with our chapter summaries, and thanks to DragonMount.com for hosting the podcast. If you see anything in this particular episode that you think we've missed or, you know, you'd like to discuss further, there are, of course, a large number of ways to get a hold of us. You can always call and leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
And you can always email us at podcast@dragonmount.com. One or more of us will usually read and respond to those within a fairly short period of time.
You can also find us in both the forum section at dragonmount.com/forums and in the comments sections following each of the individual podcasts. Pop into either one of those and leave us a message or start a particular chat vein. And usually we're on those fairly frequently and like to post some back and forth and continue the discussions from the podcast that we've had.
Absolutely. And you can also follow the Fourth Age and Dragon Mount on Facebook and Twitter. I believe the Facebook page is the Fourth Age and Twitter is Fourth Age with no space in between the number 4, T-H-A-G-E. Yeah, I'd also like to take a moment to thank Josh Needleman, who actually won a contest to provide the music for the introduction and the ending of the Fourth Age. So we'd like to thank him for that. You can find his music on MySpace at MySpace/Josh Needleman. Okay, so I guess that's pretty much it. We thank you once again for being a part of this podcast. Thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoy it as much as we do doing it. And so until the next episode, this is Virginia saying, may the light illumine you until we meet again.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravian and Doman Shima, Dai Shite.
The Fourth Age podcast is brought to you by DragonMount.com. To contact us, visit our website, DragonMount.com/podcast.
Isn't it remarkable how many really gorgeous people there are in the Wheel of Time series? I guess it's a little bit like television and movies in that respect. I mean, there are very few just plain ugly people, and not that many ordinary plain-looking ones.
Garot fell into a trap and lost several banners of men. Garot? Is that a typo? No, it's gotta be Garot. Okay, never mind.
That's true. All hail the message cow. What did we do without it?
Well, you know, Demandrid was smart enough to have sent it for us.
Yeah, you have to be careful. I'm glad it wasn't a sheep, though. I find that sheep are very tardy.
Well, and they have problems with pronunciation.
That's true. They do. But, you know, sheep and cows are ever so much more intelligent than pigeons. Mere pigeons. I mean, what are they but flying rats?
Very, very true. I don't know, it's weird when you get a message telling you to go to Farmadden.